This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots and our special Conservative Party Conference edition. We're live from a room in the conference centre, and we are on day two of Tory Party Conference.
Wait, Katie, can we do that thing in any questions with the audience applaud? Right, pretend we're any questions. So,
okay, we say let's try that again.
Welcome. So pretend your dimble beer, whoever doesn't have it.
Okay, how are they going to... You need to make the sign when I stop talking.
Okay, right.
Okay, fine.
You're making some noise, right? What on my signal?
Hello and welcome to Conservative Party Conference and live coffee house shots. We're on day two of conference with our live audience. Now, it's day two of the conference. It's rather more stable than previous Conservative Party conferences, if you think about the past 4 or 5 years, where there's plenty of Tory turmoil. To begin, Isabel, what would you describe as the mood?
Yeah, it's an interesting mood, not least because we have a very strange setup in terms of the hall and the speeches. And Katie and I had the great pleasure of being at Labour Party conference last week, where the hall really is the sort of centre of things, because there are votes and debates and people shouting at each other and heckling and so on. You don't really get that at the Tory Party conference, not just because people are a little bit more polite here, but also because it's much more stage managed, and the hall is much, much smaller this year even than normal Conservative Party conferences. I know there's the special Boris Hall for later, but really it's the size of a sort of large fringe meeting room, the sort of room that Boris Johnson used to turn up to when he was a backbencher and used to sell out fringe events a long time ago. I think, so the mood feels a little bit less febrile than Labour conference, purely because of that. But I think there is also a feeling of slight insecurity amongst lots of members and MPs who I've been speaking to, who really want a couple of things from this conference. One of them is just to check what Conservative identity is. The pandemic has shaken a lot of that up. Obviously, the Conservatives in government have spent quite a lot of money, which is not particularly normal for Conservatives, and we have a conflict at the heart of government over how much that can continue between Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. I think there's also a debate about taxing and whether taxes are going to go up again, something the Prime Minister has refused to rule out. And then also, there's just the debate about who might take over from Boris Johnson in the future. There's lots of people lining up to give their auditions on that front, and we have obviously just heard from Rishi Sunak on that front as well.
Now, as well as being joined by Isabel James from Syphon Fraser Nelson, we have political consultant Frank Luntz here, and I think we're going to talk about the Chancellor's speech. But before we get there, I thought we could talk more generally about some of the messaging. So what is the buzzword of this conference? It appears to be levelling up, but we're yet to quite work out what that means. I think Michael Gove is talking just as we're talking, so maybe in an hour or so. Frank, what do you make of Boris Johnson's slogans? Do you think that the levelling up agenda is something which is having an impact, catching fire, even though we might not quite know what it means, do you think it is having an impact?
I do want to, before answering that, I noticed that you got Joe Biden in a wheelchair as part of your chocolate. I know he's old. Takes him an hour and a half to watch 60 Minutes, he's so old. His favorite painting is The Last Supper. If you look carefully, it's the second waiter from the left. He calls himself a constitutionalist. He ought to. He was there when they wrote the document. If anyone's got a copy of the booklet, the convention booklet, if you can bring it up here, because I want to show you something about the messaging. I could really use it.
Well, that's a good test. How many are you paying attention?
He wants to give up. Yeah, there we go. Okay. You should get chocolate.
So,
yeah.
Which one did you get? Who's on the cover?
That's Her Majesty.
Oh, you got the best one. Good for you.
Her Majesty. That's really good.
Getting on with the job is the slogan on the front page. You guys created the most amazing, short, concise, powerful slogan. Get it done. Why did you expand it to getting on with the job? So I'm going to ask you by a vote, since I'm a pollster, which is more effective? You can take the party's position, getting on with the job, Or you can choose get it done. How many of you would say getting on with the job? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Get out. How many of you would say get it done? Almost everyone. You're the smart ones. The other 11 people, you're going to go back to Tony Blair days when you're in the minority. It's easy. Messaging is easy. And for some reason, I see this party makes it more difficult. I'll give you another example. About 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, they came out with an anti-crime. By the way, you are very courageous. If you can stand up and turn around, I want everyone to see your shirt. So it looks like he just got back from Hawaii. Either that or someone threw up on the shirt. I don't know which is which.
So didn't we meet last night? Yes. And weren't you wearing the same shirt? Oh. You've had a good conference, haven't you, sir? Anyway, sure.
Okay, I do the jokes here. I'm the special guest. They talked about a crime agenda. Here's the problem. If you're talking about crime and you're the government, it means, by definition, you're failing. If you acknowledge that you need a new focus on crime, you're acknowledging that you're not succeeding. This government should have done something on public safety. When you think of crime, you think of knives, you think of unsafe streets, you think of the conflict with the police and citizens. When you think about public safety, most of you probably think about safe streets, safe neighborhoods. And I don't understand why they made that choice. Another example is the difference between sustainability and cleaner, safer, healthier. Sustainability is the status quo. Sustainability means that this country is going to be exactly the same 100 years from now, which is good. But what did the people of the UK want? They want better. And the Conservatives understand that and build back better. Well, cleaner, safer, healthier. You should always be on the side of better. You should always be on the side of the future rather than the past. So my challenge to those who set messaging is not to write it yourselves, but to go to the voters and let them write it for you. Put the people first. And one last point. I always try, and I can't do it here because I don't have enough time, I always try to go to the audience before I say even a single word. That's what the Conservatives should be doing. If you want to say you're the party of the people, let the people speak first. If you say that you're truly listening, listen first. Did any one of you drive more than 3 hours to get here? Raise your hands. More than 4 hours to get here? 5 hours to get here? One person, stand up. What's your name?
James.
James. How old are you?
20.
Are you legal? Okay, put that booze down. It's 18 here. God, I love this country. You're okay, we got two of you. What's your name? You're with him. You were the driver. Okay, so it's your fault. So because the two of you came the furthest, you're now on the podcast. And what's your name?
Gabriel.
What do you want the people of Britain to know about you, about your generation, and why you're here at party conference? And speak up.
Wait, can we get a microphone, Nash? Actually, for the ease of recording, I'll record you locally.
And there's a lesson to this. If they're going to drive 5 hours to get here, first off, they're crazy. Secondly, if this is where you really, really want to be, there's something wrong with you. But good for you. Because if we have more young people like them that are willing to drive 5 hours to participate in democracy, this democracy succeeds. So I'm glad, I'm grateful that you guys come here. So what message would you send to the people of Britain? What do you want them to know?
Politics is about winning, having fun, and free drinks. Why is it about free drinks? Because alcohol duty is too high. One third of the price of a pint is taxed. £6 for a pint, £2 of tax. It could be a £4 pint. Not good enough.
The preceding message was from Alcoholics Anonymous. And why did you come here?
Everything that he said, plus the other thing that I would say too is
You know, I'm not from the UK, I'm actually from Brazil. And as someone from Brazil, I believe in conservative values. So when I came here, I was analyzing and I was realizing how extremely liberal young people are. And I don't think that's the answer. So I believe in something different and I wanted to be part of something different. And I knew that the only way to get something different is through the Conservative Party. Because there's no other way, not with our voting system. That's the reason why I'm here today. And what he said as well about free drinks.
Well, there you go. So I'm going to give it back to you, but my warning to you all is that the average age of a conservative voter is deceased. You don't have enough young people. You don't have enough people, first, second, third time voters. So before they leave, listen to them, learn from them. This is how you will maintain the majority. If young people see their future in the Conservative Party, because you know the people over age 50 do, you'll stay in the majority forever. So thanks for this.
Thank you, Frank. Just very briefly, how do you rate the leveling up slogan? We've heard about the front of the book. But
thank you very much for being here. I'm going to run now. No, I'm not. I don't rate it at all. And here's the reason why. There are too many people who think that leveling up is at their expense. They all know who's going to benefit. They all think that they're going to pay for it. And so, no, it's not great. Build Back Better, very strong. Bring It Home is very strong. Leveling up, not as good.
James, how is the government's leveling up agenda going? It is at the title of many panels here, and yet I think the furthest we've got is a Neil O'Brien tweet, which has four brief bullet points.
I think there are two challenges for levelling up. The first is, as Frank said, that too many people feel that it's code for taxing the South to spend in the North. And I think that creates problems for it as a slogan. And I think you see ministers trying to explain why the South benefits. You know, when we interviewed Dominic Raab ahead of conference, he was saying, well, look, as a Surrey MP, I think levelling up is good because if you had more prosperity and better jobs spread more evenly across the country, that would reduce the pressure to build new housing in Surrey. I think that is quite a convoluted explanation to people. And then I think the second challenge with levelling up is the government wants to shoehorn everything in to levelling up. So crime gets put into levelling up. Public health gets put into levelling up. And I think if you do that, it ceases to be an agenda and becomes a slogan, like Build Back Better, rather than an actual set of policies. I think levelling up should be much more narrowly defined. And I think levelling up should be about boosting economic growth and productivity in the regions. And I think that is largely these days, a lot of that is about digital infrastructure as well as skills. And then I think the second thing it should be about is devolving power down. If you look at the places in the UK that are interesting and dynamic, and I would include Manchester as one of them, they generally have one thing in common, and that is a local mayor who can act as someone who can push things through, get things done, bring together, you know, all the various government agencies and quangos, and can sell the place around the world. And I think that is one of the things that we need much more of in this country. This country has been far too centralized for far too long, and we need far more figures outside London who can extol the benefits of their place and can help get things done there. I think that's what levelling up should be about.
Fraser, what do you think levelling up should be about? You've, like James, have written plenty of columns on it.
Yeah, because it basically indicates a vacuum where a policy should be. That's my problem with it. Plenty of people think it means taxing the North, so taxing the South to bribe the North. But I think it was a sort of holding strategy where Boris Johnson works out what he was really going to do with his premiership. I mean, of course, we all know what the aim is, that you can benefit some part of the country without taxing the others. That was before they broke the manifesto pledge to increase taxes. And so you do get the impression that behind such vague language does come an unpleasant message, which we're going to end up paying for one way or another in the end. I like to think that out of this conference, or perhaps, if not this one, the next one, we might get a slightly better cri de coeur from the Conservative Party. It's interesting about the basic question with these conferences is really, and I'd be interested to know what our guests in the audience think,
you walk away thinking, what's this government all about? What's conservatism about? Why, if you're a party member, are you a conservative rather than in the Labour Party? Now, Brexit is almost something which transcends left and right. You can be a Labour voter, you can want Brexit done. Boris Johnson delivered in spades on that particular promise. But beyond that, why would you join the Conservative Party? Why would you drive 4 hours, 5 hours to a conference here? And to what extent do you think the values of his government reflect that Conservative mission? What is it all about? If you can leave this conference with more of a message, then you have spent your time well. If you leave it without much of an idea, then we can see trouble ahead for the government.
Isabel, do you think Michael Gove's appointment, fronting up that levelling up agenda, is now in the name of his department, from the reshuffle, indicates that it is going to get a new lease of life?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Gove is obviously a big thinker, and he's someone who's very good at coming into departments. We're all very familiar with what he did at education, but lots of other departments that he then went into, so environment, for instance, justice, he sort of turned what his predecessors had done on its head, and quoted a long reading list when he was explaining why he was doing that as well. And he did that again last night at a fringe that I was covering, where he was talking about levelling up, partly in terms of not imposing ugly homes on communities, which I think is one way of turning his predecessor, Robert Jenrick's legacy, on its head, and trying to reassure Conservative members that they're not going to be antagonised with inappropriate developments in their area. He also talked, not in a particularly abstract way, but he was trying to outline lots of concepts yesterday about the sort of ties that bind communities and institutions in left-behind communities that have basically fallen apart. And he talked about high streets in particular, where you've just got charity shops, voids and chains, and nothing that really makes them have a character that's part of a town. And that's something that I feel quite acutely, because I spend a lot of my time in Barrow and Furness in Cumbria, which, if you go to the high street, you'll have quite a downbeat view of, because it's got lots of voids, charity shops and chains. But actually, the town itself, its economy is booming, and it's just that its soul isn't manifested in its high street anymore. So for Gove to be focusing on that, a lot of Red Wall MPs, and Barrow is now one of those, it's represented by a Tory for the first time in a long time, will really identify with that, because it's something that people talk about in those towns. They say, this town is going to the dogs, because when they walk down the high street, it looks messy. And so that's one of the things that Gove identified. But there was another really interesting omission in what he was talking about, or what he wasn't talking about at this fringe. He didn't talk about infrastructure at all. So I think a lot of people, when Boris Johnson started talking about levelling up, envisaged lots of cranes sort of, driving up to the north and starting to build things. There was no mention of that at all. And actually, I think his pitch last night felt a lot more like a thoughtful version of the big society that David Cameron talked about. And there's obviously quite a lot of risks there, because David Cameron talked about the big society and then did absolutely nothing with it at all. Whereas I think Michael Gove has managed to flesh out what conservatives see as society and what conservatives see as the state's role in boosting societies in parts of the country that have felt left behind. It was interesting, but I think distilling that into anything concrete is quite difficult, because you are still talking about people working together and communities, rather than saying, the government levelled this up and built this thing in our town by the next election.
Now, before we move to our next topic, which will be tax, Frank, I wondered, given that you're saying it is a slogan which suggests that you're taking away, is there anything that you think can be done to it to ease voter concerns, if that's a weakness, or do you have an alternative phrase?
Well, Build Back Better is not a slogan. Build Back Better is a commitment. But it's a very dangerous commitment to make. I play the opposition in the campaigns I work on. And I, therefore, in a case like this, in this room, I would be Labor. And I'd be asking the question, what is better? What is actually improved? Are the roads better today than they were a few years ago? You know how long it takes to build a road. It is impossible to make a difference between now and the next election on roads. How long does it take to build a hospital, to get it approved here? How long does it take to build a school, get it approved, get it in the ground, and get it open? I'm afraid that 2 years from now, this stuff is going to be in the midst of being built, and it's actually going to agitate people, because it'll be half built. It'd be a mess, take longer to drive. already takes a long time. And in fact, I'm also nervous about cost. Prices are going up right now. Prices are going up. Taxes are going up. It's more expensive, the cost of living. How are you going to explain that? In some presentations, I'm very positive. In this one, I'm actually very negative, just based on what I'm responding to. You're going to have to prove that you actually made a tangible difference. And I wonder how many of you could get up and do it right now, because I know what I would do. They promised you they wouldn't raise your taxes. You've seen the manifesto. The word is guarantee. We guarantee that we will not raise taxes. Well, now defend yourself. Because if I can't trust you on that, what can I trust you on? That's the kind of challenge that you guys are going to face.
Frank, can I ask you a quick question on this? I don't know how many people in this room are. How many here have campaigned for the Conservative Party in the past? Right. How many of you are not looking forward to meeting people asking about whether they can trust you because you promised not to raise taxes and then did? How many of you think people will understand if you say, well, it was a pandemic, we had to break it? Okay. What do you think, Frank? When you make from George W. Bush's Read My Lips, I think Boris himself repeated that phrase on LBC, read my lips, no new taxes. Would voters think, well, we understand why you broke your promise because there was a pandemic in an extremist circumstance?
The answer is yes, but you have to make that context. And you guys launched the decision to raise taxes in 48 hours from when it first hit the press to when the actual presentation, maybe 72 hours. How can you explain something this important in 72 hours? You have to set the context. Boris is a very lucky man, and he's very important. I speak in favor of him, and I tell all of you to leave him alone, because he's going to bring over voters that no conservative could otherwise touch. But the compromise there is he's going to support things that you all don't support. It's a very tough balancing act. And a question that I would love to see the Spectator spend a whole issue doing is, what is more important? Is it more important to keep labor out of government, or is it more important to force the conservatives to behave the way they promised they would over the last 40 years? I don't know what the answer. In fact, I'm going to ask you that question. Which should be a higher priority? Keep labor out of running this government, or force the conservatives to return to conservative principles? Who chooses conservative principles? Raise your hands. Who chooses forcing labor, keeping labor out of government?
I'd say it's about 80-20 splits.
Yes.
How many of you think that there need not be a contradiction between those two things? Hands up, probably about a third. Okay, interesting. So a good chunk of you do think that there is a contradiction between being true to conservative values and winning power at the next election. Which is quite significant. Just somebody who does think that, can just let me know which conservative values you think would go down badly amongst voters at the next election. Anyone? Yeah, sir? Right, okay. So, anyway, sorry, to be honest, I'm getting ahead of myself here. This isn't a Q&A session, but Frank raised such an interesting point there. Okay.
Now, before we get to Q&A...
By the way, she can cut me out of the edit. That's the great thing about these podcasts. When I rab it on like this, she goes, yeah, that's not going to get in the final anyway. Sorry.
Director's cut. Now, before we get to the Q&A, which is coming shortly, so please get your questions and get ready for your chocolate. We have heard from the Chancellor today, and we're talking about taxes, but it was a mixed speech, because clearly it's a difficult background, in a way, going into this conference, in the sense there's lots of Tory MPs, ministers, activists, very uncomfortable with the fact that there is a national insurance rise, the general direction in terms of taxation, yet the Tories are riding high in the polls. Boris Johnson looks in a very powerful position. And it doesn't really feel as though any of those rebellions are about to have much impact. But yet, what did Rishi Sunak try to do with his speech today when it comes to that resistance?
So I thought what was striking about the speech was the attempt to put fiscal responsibility as the kind of key conservative value. essentially arguing that, you know, you can't, there's nothing more unconservative than just borrowing the money to pay for things. I think one of the things that happened during COVID was you saw the government announcing huge amounts of money with absolutely no explanation of where, how they were going to be funded, because they were essentially going to be funded by QE. And that was, I think, a legitimate approach in the time. You couldn't have funded something like furlough out of taxation. It wouldn't have been the appropriate thing to do. But I think now, as we've come out of the acute phase, hopefully, out of the acute phase of COVID, I think you do need to restore the link between the idea that if the government is going to spend money, it has to raise that money somehow. So I thought that was the first thing he was trying to do. The second thing I thought he was trying to do was to say, look, if we are fiscally responsible over the next few years, that opens up the prospects of tax cuts. And it certainly, I think, from anyone going knocking on doors, if the Tories have cut taxes before the next election, then I think it becomes easier to explain and justify why, to deal with the NHS backlog, you had to do this one-off tax rise. And I think that is the question. I think that the mood I sense among ministers and MPs is this. It is that the national insurance rise has acted almost as a bucket of cold water. I think people are much less inclined now to push for higher spending than they were before, because they've seen that higher spending has to be paid for. The second thing is, there is a feeling that the Tory party essentially has, and Frank might disagree with this, but has so far got away with it in terms of raising taxes. But, you know, once is explicable, twice begins to look like a pattern of behaviour. So there can't be another rise in personal taxation before the next election. That, I think, is complicated, because if you think the NHS is going to hand over this money that it is getting and give it to social care, I've got a bridge to sell you. There is absolutely no way the NHS is going to surrender this money once it's got it, because it is going to have a perfect argument for keeping hold of it whatever happens. If the NHS has cleared the backlog, it will say, look, look how much better the health service is with this extra investment. They'll call it investment, they always do. And imagine that the quality of healthcare we could have going forward if we kept this. If they haven't cleared the backlog, they'll say, well, you gave us this money to clear the backlog, and we haven't finished clearing the backlog, so you can't take away this funding at this point. So I think that is the challenge. But and I think the next challenge is, in the spending review, can you keep a lid on other spending to the extent that it begins to open up the prospect of tax cuts before the next election in 2023 or 2024?
Isabel, Rishi Sunak in his speech today was almost, he was hinting at maybe a tax cut somewhere in the future if everyone could just behave for now. Do you think MPs genuinely believe there is a chance we might get a tax cut before the next election?
Well, I think they're certainly agitating for that. And I think more than that, they're currently still very anxious that there's going to be a tax rise. I think the next election and a tax cut seem so far in the distance, and that there's, you know, a big mountain in terms of potential second tax rise, which is why you've had warnings from people like Graham Brady in the past few days that the Conservatives cannot put up, and Jacob Rees-Mogg actually, that the Conservatives cannot put up tax anymore. I also thought that that Rishi Sunak's speech, I thought it was interesting. It was a sort of mix of him trying to charm the Conservative Party and also defend himself and the wider party against Labour attack lines. So he didn't refer to universal credit, but he did talk about the cost of living and talked about a young family with, you know, parents who were working hard and trying to put a bit of money aside. And then he said, now you tell me, is the answer to their hopes and dreams just to increase their benefits? But another thing that Conservative MPs are very agitated about, perhaps paradoxically, is that a lot of them think that our current level of benefits is not generous enough. If you talk to, I think, any of the former work and pensions secretaries, they think that putting universal credit up by £20 a week was probably, on balance, a good thing. And even though they recognise that they've lost the battle on the uplift, there's still a push by those MPs, by those former secretaries of state, to try to get the level of universal credit higher. So it's not just a sort of an attack line from the Labour Party, it's also a debate within his own party. But just in terms of the way that he talked about himself to the hall, I don't know how many of you were sitting in there. But I think we've all during the pandemic got very used to brand Rishi with the, you know, the signature and the glossy videos. And today it was a bit like those adverts for that spinning bike, the really expensive one, Peloton, which he has one of those apparently. And it was almost like he was sort of still in one of his spinning classes because there was that motivational music on the video. And then he came in and started talking about whatever it takes. And then a bit later he talked about, you know, now's not the time to have a rest. And I almost thought he was going to start shouting, come on, make it count. What are you doing it for? And all the weird, cheesy things that they say in spinning classes, maybe even have a mirror ball. But he was trying to kind of introduce himself as Brand Rishi to the hall because his ambitions don't just stop at being Chancellor, which is why he was talking about his time in California, about the things he believes in. I mean, he had a list of his core beliefs that he gave to the hall, which, you know, might be useful in terms of pushing back against colleagues who want higher spending, but also might be quite useful if you're trying to build the sort of power base, fan base that, well, Peloton instructors have and that also that future leadership contenders might have as well.
Now, on the subject of future leadership contenders, Frank, we don't have you for that much longer because you're going to dart off. So before you go, when it comes to eventual successes for Boris Johnson, I don't think anyone thinks the Prime Minister is going anywhere anytime soon. Rishi Sunak's talked up. We've had a Conservative home poll out today, which I think has Liz Truss as now the new Foreign Secretary, as now the most popular member of the Cabinet, according to Conservative members. Ben Wallace close behind her, then David Frost. Anyone catching your eye?
Well, I'm going to ask you guys. I'm going to give you five choices. Rishi, Sajid, Priti, Michael Gove, Liz Truss.
Oh, we're going to have a little impromptu leadership election here.
Yes.
Okay.
This is the right place. This is the right institution. We're going to do it by applause, not by hand gesture. So I'm going to give you a name. You can only vote once. This is not Chicago. You get to vote one time. Again, Rishi, Sajid, Priti, Michael, and Liz. Who chooses Rishi? Applaud. Who chooses Sajid? Priti. Thank you, Mr. Patel. Thank you very much. Your wife appreciates it. Who chooses Michael Gove? Who chooses Liz Truss? Okay, we have to have a winner. I think it's between three people. You only get to vote for Rishi, Gove, or Truss. Raise your hands this time. Rishi, raise your hands. You're going to be the arbiter. Okay. Who says Gove? It's close. Yeah. Who says Truss? She wins.
Wow. You heard it here first. So Liz Truss beats both Rishi Sunak and Michael Gove in the Spectator podcast listeners' impromptu election.
Which is good because I'm going to be seeing her in a few minutes, so I can...
The campaign started here, people. You were here when it happened.
Yes.
In the room where it happened.
That's a great play, by the way. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Just know that in America, we don't do this anymore. We don't read intelligent publications. We don't really have these kinds of intellectual conversations. And so for me, who is a foreigner and does not truly qualify to be sitting up here, the chance to do a spectator event is probably the highlight of my conference. Thank you very much and have a good panel.
Thanks, Brian. Great. And with that, if anyone wants to stay, we're going to take some questions from the audience, minus Frank. So have you got some glamorous microphone assistance? I'm looking. Yes. Okay, great. Raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Okay, let's go for the man in the corner.
Jim Morris, pathologist from Lancaster. Socialism has got one big advantage over the Conservative Party, and that is Sir Michael Marmot, who has shown that equality makes us healthier. And the phrase levelling up has taken that away from the Labour Party, and I think it's brilliant. And we should level up and put a lot of emphasis on levelling up, but level up on health, because you can do that, you can improve the health of the entire community without taking it away from anybody. Very difficult to do economically, but you can do it on health, and that's what should be done.
Okay.
Thank you, and we're going to take a few questions at a time, so if you can do the man in the gilet, also on the front row, benefits of sitting for a...
Hi. My question, I think, is it was about a year or so ago, maybe a little longer, there was a great Leader article which was around what's it called when you let people who've come in illegally an amnesty.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting perspective that you put. Bearing in mind like what's happening now, and you know, as we speak, there are probably boats coming over, right? It's something we're all seeing and thinking we need to do something about it. Do you still stand by that article? And would you bring that out today?
The gentleman is referring to probably my least popular opinion, that I suppose, in the leader page of The Spectator, that we are, the magazine should continue to be in favour of an earned amnesty for illegal migrants. That was a policy when Boris Johnson was editor. It's something that Kate Andrews and I did a debate on. We firmly believe it. However, there's no doubt about it. It is probably the most unpopular policy in politics. Yes, I do stand by it for two reasons. One is that there are still something like 1 million undocumented people in this country. We're talking not people who like arrived yesterday on an illegal boat, but people who, like we saw with the Windrush scandal, whose status, they might have lived here amongst us, working amongst us, they might be our colleagues, our neighbours, who might never have quite got their papers in order, but still, technically, would be eligible for deportation if somebody like Theresa May were to implement the hostile environment. I also think that right now, where there is such a massive shortage of workers, now is the perfect time for the government to come up with an earned amnesty. I'm not saying you immediately make everybody in the country legal tomorrow. There'll be certain conditions. If you've been here for a number of years, if you have had a criminal record, if you've been an upstanding member of society, then I don't see why you shouldn't be documented. I think that after the pandemic, in the middle of a labour crisis, and also Brexit, is the perfect opportunity to give that kind of fairness. In America, they talk about this a lot. You guys will almost think of this as an American debate. But that's not because America has got undocumented migrants and we don't. We do. We just pretend they don't exist. These are, I would say, in many meaningful ways, our countrymen. And the great advantage of Brexit and controlling the borders means that you gain permission to be more liberal in other areas. I think being liberal in terms of offering earned amnesty to those who've been in our country for years and, frankly, you know, are constructive members of our society, is one of the good things that we can do from a dividend from voting to leave the EU.
James, do you want to take the socialism levelling up point?
Yeah, I think you're clearly right that one of the things that the Tory party needs to show...
Sorry, you want to... let's say, well, I'll come over to you.
Chocolate.
You've got to
do the promise, yeah.
Which one do you want? Sorry, I've eaten half of that. I forgot, because these guys don't really want to ask questions. You just did that for the chocolate, didn't you?
You've got two bars of chocolate so far. Okay, right, James.
Do you want chocolate?
I think the Tory party has to be a one nation...
James, let's answer the question first, and then we'll get to the chocolate. James.
I think you're clearly right that electorally, you have to look like, to be an effective political party, you have to look like you want and are serious about representing the whole country, not just the most prosperous parts of a country or parts of a country that already vote for you. I think on health, one of the most difficult bits of that decision... And I realise we might be about to be accused of hypocrisy here, considering our rewards for questions, is dealing with obesity and all of those other questions. I think if you look at one of the reasons, there are obviously multiple reasons why the UK was hit so hard by COVID. I think one of them is that we as a population are not particularly healthy. We have a lot of people who are overweight, and a lot of people who are kind of clinically obese. And I think we have to think about how we handle that. I think that, you know, we can get into debates about sugar taxes and all that sort of stuff. I think one change I think we should see is I think we should have a change for national curriculum, that no one should leave school without knowing how to cook and how to eat healthily. I think that that is one of the big problems. I think people eat very unhealthily in lots of times simply because they don't know how to eat healthily, and the education system fails to teach them that. I mean, that is something that we could remedy quite quickly, and I think that would have a really beneficial effect on health inequality across the country.
Isabel, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just your point about Marmot. I covered the Marmot review when it came out 10 years ago, and it's quite depressing that when we've had the 10 years since Marmot, not very much has improved, actually, and it took a pandemic to really expose a lot of the points that were made by that review a decade ago. But I think at the very least, one of the good things about COVID is it has underlined a lot of the warnings in that report about inequality of access to the things that make us healthy. So good housing, green space. And if we're having a debate, as the Conservative Party are at the moment, about planning and about how homes should be built, part of that can't just be what their facade looks like. It has to also be about their setting, about whether social housing, for instance, has outdoor space for people. There's been that big row in London about that ridiculous swimming pool in Nine Elms, the one in the sky. But actually, one of the bigger problems for social housing and the affordable housing parts of developments is that the green spaces that the open market homes have are not accessible to the social tenants, for instance. Often people aren't given balconies in social properties because architects fear that they might store their stuff on them because they don't have enough space in their homes. So there has to be a debate actually within the Conservative Party, not just about how the houses look to the people who already live in that area. It's all about also about how people who are going to live in those new homes are going to experience them and how they're going to improve their lives. Because at the moment, we are building homes that are not improving people's lives. They're actually, in a lot of cases, making them more cramped and more stressful. You want your chocolate?
Yeah. I think James is quite right. People should be drinking less and having less chocolate. By the way, gins are at the back and free chocolate.
Right.
For...
we're going to take another round of questions.
Look at this. This
welcome
chocolate,
to Claim.
Isn't it?
Leah,
right.
We might need some chocolate.
Why don't
you
take them in groups of threes or something?
Yep, I will do.
Leah, can I get some more chocolate?
Okay, fine. So can we go with, let's go near the back. The man on the aisle, further back, the furthest back man on this side. Really good directions. Yep, great.
Hi, what is the panel's...
Keep your hands up so I can then... Yeah, sorry.
What
yeah.
is the panel's interpretation of what young people want?
Okay. And then let's go... if you just go down, say, to the next man on the aisle. Great.
Hello. Social care, James mentioned it before. The proposals, assuming that they get some funding at all, don't seem to actually address the problem of fixing social care, rather than they seem to be particularly aimed at protecting people's houses, predominantly in the south. When are we going to fix social care? And indeed, what is a proper Conservative response to doing so?
Great. And then third question, can we just go to the man quite far back with his... Yeah, I think you know my vibe. Bit far along. Yeah, great.
I just like the whole debate on the slogans, and I think levelling up is only bad if you've become too much of a southerner party. I think for the rest of the country, levelling up is all right. I think the public understand that there's been a pandemic, and they understand that taxes are going to go up. We shouldn't treat the public like they're fools. As far as raising taxes for adult social care, 90% of this audience probably own their home. They've got parents who are coming to that period, and they've got a real problem with them being fleeced at the end of their lives. And then when we said Build Back Better wasn't good, we all remember things can only get better. And your average Labour supporter knows exactly what that means. And my final point is, we've just had a battle in the pandemic. I was one of the people that believed in the economy. It was economy versus health, the economy lost. So the Conservative Party just needs to change.
Okay, great. So we have what do young people want? We have social care, and is there actually a Tory solution? And on slogans, actually, is this, do we need to rethink, and is that a focus on health that should be there? James, do you want to just kick it off, and then we'll go to Isabel?
So I think on young people, what makes young people vote Conservative? It's owning their own home. It is the simple, and I think this is one of the biggest challenges for the Tory party, which is how do you allow more young people to become homeowners when it is clear how politically difficult any kind of reform of the planning system is. I think there's a real danger that if you end up with, I think the average age at which people switch to voting Tory is now 42. If home ownership moves further and further out of people's reach, that is going to go backwards. And I think there are lots of reasons why London is so inhospitable for the Tories now. But it is worth remembering that in 87, I think the Tories won 2/3 of the seats in London. And the Tory decline in London is, I think, clearly the decline in London home ownership has contributed to that, the number of people living in rented properties. I think the Tory party at some point is going to have to bite the bullet on this. And I know they have shied away from it now, but if they do not allow more young people to become homeowners, the Tory party will run into real electoral trouble, because the Tory party is the party of the property-owning democracy, or it is nothing. And if young people cannot get on the housing ladder, that is going to come back and really bite the Tories.
Isabel, perhaps you could touch on social care and then maybe a little bit on slogans. I'm going to do a final round of questions, and perhaps Fraser might join us once he's finished his lunch.
Yeah, it was interesting that you asked when are we going to fix social care, because I think if there were a minister on this panel, they'd say, oh, but we've fixed it. We've introduced this tax. Well done us. But actually, all that does is change the financial settlement for social care. It doesn't improve the quality of care. It doesn't lengthen visits. It doesn't improve the quality of staffing or pay within the sector at all. And the sector has been very noisily warning about a looming, I would say a looming shortage, but it already has a staffing shortage, but it's about to have a staffing crisis in the coming weeks, where a huge number of its staff who haven't been vaccinated are just going to have to leave. And you talk to social care bosses, and they say that they've already had this drain of staff going from their care homes into the NHS, where compulsory vaccination is not yet a policy. I know the government are consulting on that. But they're saying, we don't know where we're going to get the staff from. And you might argue, it's a moral duty for someone who's caring for the frail and vulnerable and disabled people of our country to have got a vaccination. But the reality is that they haven't. And if they're moving from care homes into the NHS, then they're going to be on a hospital ward where there are frail and elderly and disabled people who they're going to be working with. So I think there is an issue here of a lack of planning from the government, which I think probably of all the things that Labour complains about, it sort of ended up in a stopped clock being right, once or twice a day. Actually, it is the government doesn't have a plan for this yet. And I think the idea that it has fixed social care is going to come undone very quickly and very soon as well.
Great. And now let's take a final two questions. Can we go for the lady with the long hair near the back by the aisle? To the other side. Clearly you can tell everyone I don't know my left and right. There we go.
Hi, I remember back in the spring reading an article written by you, Katie, about the excitement around COP26, Boris's big plans to make it as big as the London 2012 Olympics, and this desire of his to go down in history as a great green leader. But since then, I mean, I've barely even heard about COP26 in the news. The excitement seems to have really withered away about this. So do you think that Boris has lost his chance to go down as this great green leader in history? And if he has, what do you think his legacy will be instead?
Great. And then let's take just one more question. So let's go for the man with the grey jacket. Yeah, that's the guy.
Thank you very much. Is repealing the sugar tax and the glorious restoration of the neon orange nectar not just the right thing to do, but the key to saving the union?
Okay. I feel like these are very clearly questions for Katie as an iron brew drinker.
So iron brew. Great. Do we need a third question, or should I? I think we're running out of time. So, on iron brew, of course, it's of course close to my heart. I wrote about iron brew in this week's magazine. And I discovered on Saturday night, in case anyone wants to go slightly out the centre of Manchester in Sale, a restaurant called Roti that does iron brew Negronis. Highly recommend. But yeah, I'm sure that would help with the union.
Katie sent me a picture of his Iron Brew Negroni. So excited was she to come across it. So, you know, when in Rome, guys.
Just on COP26, and then perhaps we can go to the panel for the union to end this. I think, to be honest, Boris Johnson still sees it as an important moment for his government. I think that climate is seen in government as something which can detoxify parts of the Tory party and is seen as almost a great unifier. But clearly, and the panel I chaired before this one in this room was on net zero and green growth, the cost of net zero means it is quite a tricky sell. I don't think you can, as much as I think Boris Johnson is one of the most optimistic people on the agenda, you don't have to look far around the cabinet table to see, you know, nervous, sweating ministers when we're talking about the cost of getting there. And we've heard earlier today on the panel from people like Ben Houchen, the Tees Valley mayor, that they're very, you know, behind the agenda in green jobs, but this constant move from 2050 to 2035 is making them nervous because the technology isn't necessarily there yet. So I think the sad news for COP26 was that Chris Martin could not play at it, but we do have the mascot, which is Bonnie the Seal. Sadly, it seems you've missed this, but they have brought out a seal mascot to try and get people in the mood, and David Attenborough there. So I think you might still get some festival spirit in advance of it. But the green agenda is important to the Prime Minister, 100%. I think net zero and levelling up are the two big planks, but I just think there's enough issues coming up the track with net zero that at least those around Boris Johnson are getting nervous about it. And an international agreement on COP is proving quite difficult in the sense that it's not clear China's even going to attend because there's two parts to it. Now, ultimately, it is an international negotiation. It's just the government thought there'd be a domestic element too. But I think on the international negotiation, yes, there'll be some wins. But if China doesn't go to Glasgow, I think that just means that you're not going to have that breakthrough moment that they initially wanted. And it also means domestically, any measures are a much harder sell because you already hear Tory MPs like Craig McKinley and others say, well, why should our voters suffer if we don't do, you know, things like the coal mine, if we invest in higher power, more expensive technology, if people can just go to China and China aren't going to bother. So I think the international also affects the domestic like that. And just to end this podcast, perhaps James or Fraser, if it's not Iron Brew, perhaps you could tell us what you think the State of the Union is.
I think the State of the Union is pretty strong right now. Nicola Sturgeon does a very good job in persuading the whole world that Scots are absolutely itching to break it out of the Union. But in elections in May, you end up with the SNP basically one seat up from what it was before. That's after Brexit, after Boris Johnson, not much change. The support for independence is pretty much where it was at the last referendum 7 years ago. So I don't see this great unstoppable momentum of Scots heading for the exit. The situation is still precarious, but there's no doubt that Brexit makes it far more logistically difficult for Scotland to leave the UK than it did before. You're now talking about hard borders, way more economic disruption that would, as one of Sturgeon's own advisors said recently, be Brexit on the scale of like 5 or 6. So when you look at the practicalities, it's even less appealing a prospect than it was 7 years ago. But that's not to say I'm complacent. I think Sturgeon's one of the best politicians, not just in Britain, but probably in Europe. She's incredibly formidable. Still having almost half of Scots wanting to be independent isn't what you could call a safe zone. But I am not as anxious as I was about this 18 months ago. And I think that the more that the SNP's own internal failings start to catch up with it, the harder Nicola Sturgeon and her successors will have to tell Scots that more of this home rule really is the remedy that they're looking for.
So with that, thank you, Fraser, Isabel, James and Frank, who has now left the building. And thank you for listening. And particular thanks to our live audience.